I can see far away, perfect, in fact, up close to you. Kind of. I just gotta make it bigger. There's two lines on the screen at the time. And it looks like the top line of the eye chart. I think so. That's why I think we should get the new one.
We're working on it.
Have you seen the keyboard on there?
But, I mean,
you know, why don't you do a keyboard on the screen? That's pretty slick. Just like the keyboard, you just press down, right, and then you can adjust the screen to different colors.
There she goes. We'll have the clerk call the roll.
Representative Chairman Kreit?
Here.
Belter? Delzer?
Here.
Lubisberg? Havistad?
Here.
Kelsch? Jerry?
Here.
Kepenick?
Here.
Nurgles?
Here.
Lansom?
Yep.
Locke? Nelson? Pollard?
Aye.
Ruby? Schmidt?
Here.
Scarpo?
Here.
Trabier?
Here.
Senator Skelzer? Lee?
Here.
O'Connell? Lanzik? Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Aye.
Representative Chairman Weiss.
Here.
Locke. Owens.
Here.
Scarley.
Here.
Thorson.
Here.
Tolman.
Here.
Senator Sharvey. Burkhart. Marcelli. Miller.
Here.
Robinson.
Aye.
Chief Information Officer Wessler?
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
Okay. All right, we'll ride along with our agenda and we'll, you know, try to stay right on time and hopefully get everybody out of here about 4:30. So we'll have the L.R. Kimball group present the audit findings for the technology security audit and vulnerability assessment. So, proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is the committees. Got to remember to pluralize all that. Just a quick introduction. For the record, my name is Don DeFleur. I'm the Information Systems Audit Manager for the North Dakota State Auditor's Office. Last session, you guys granted us an additional $100,000 to conduct a second vulnerability assessment on the state. We elected to use that money to do vulnerability assessment on the university system since they've never had a comprehensive vulnerability study over there. The state, we've been doing it since 2005. So this is the first time we've done this sort of thing on the university system. I would certainly like to thank the university system for their cooperation on this audit. Without the work that they did, the product before you would not have happened. There was a very short time frame we had to do this, and they did an excellent job of pulling it together, having everything ready to go for us, and cooperating fully on allowing us access to the information we needed. So with that, I'll turn it over to Eric Wallace. Eric is with Telecommunication Systems. They're the subcontractor on this. L.R. Kimball was the primary contractor, but TCS was the primary one that supplied the people that came out in the field and did the work, and Eric is their supervisor. Eric has electrical engineering degrees, and he worked for the Air Force for a number of years in the signals intelligence or specialized intelligence section. He's worked for TCS for quite a number of years, first as a programmer, and then we moved him over into this branch to do the security training and the security assessments. So with that, I will hand it over to Eric Wallace.
Thank you.
Thank you all for allowing me to come out and present the findings to you. First, I'd like to reiterate what Don said.
Could you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Eric Wallace. I'm with Telecommunication Systems, representing L.R. Kimball. Again, I want to reiterate what Don said and thank specifically the North Dakota Auditor's Office, North Dakota University System, and each of the campuses that were involved. Without their support, and they were all very supportive on this, we would not have been able to pull this off in the aggressive time frame that was put forward. So we're very thankful to have their support. Tim Kimball was asked to perform a vulnerability assessment for the internal and the external information technology infrastructure of the North Dakota University System and the associated campuses. The campuses represented in the assessment were Bismarck State College, Dakota College of Bottineau, Dickinson State University, Lake Region State College, Mayville State College, Minot State University, North Dakota State College of Science, North Dakota State University, North Dakota University System offices in Fargo, Bismarck, and Grand Forks, University of North Dakota, Valley City State University, and Williston State College. The campuses and offices provide the IT resources that are utilized on a daily basis by more than 47,000 students and 11,000 faculty and staff. IT security is essential to ensure that the campuses comply with federal and state laws, regulations designed to protect sensitive information, such as education records, personally identifiable information, credit card data, and financial aid records. The campus resources are prime targets for computer hackers due to the culture of academic freedom and values of open access. In addition, the campuses provide numerous computer labs, high-capacity internet connections, and servers that can support very high computational power. The assessment represented the evaluation of about 130,000 systems for vulnerabilities. North Dakota University System and a few of the campuses that are represented have had IT security violations in the last year. These are noted within the report with public details associated with each of the events. In addition, I've included a couple of additional campuses within the United States, the University of Maryland at College Park, as well as Indiana University that had large breaches during the last year as well. I didn't mention it earlier, and I apologize for that. Each of you should have a report at your desk. If you don't have a report, let us know. But you can follow along. I'm basically traveling through the report as I go through the assessment. According to Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, and they're an organization that pulls together data associated with breaches. If you look on their site, they noted that 28 universities were breached in 2014. It's probably higher than that, but those were the ones that publicly came out and gave statistics associated with what was lost. 60% of those were due to hacking or malware injected into the university. They claim around 11% was due to insider threat, just to give you some numbers associated with what's going on. If you look at the North Dakota components, the first one was associated with unauthorized access. The second one was associated with phishing, sometimes known as social engineering. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the report. And the last one associated with malware. It wasn't clear in the report whether it was phishing or whether a student or faculty had done a drive-by download or exactly how the malware got there. Testing was performed as part of the vulnerability assessment on all network devices and within the ranges specified by each of the campuses. So we worked directly with the university system and with the campus staff themselves to define which ranges we were actually going to scan as part of the assessment. Scans checked for known vulnerabilities and weaknesses in the network and attached hosts and appliances. The relevant web applications were also assessed by the team, and all detected vulnerabilities were documented, and remediation guidance was provided to each of the campuses. So separate from this report, every one of the campuses and the North Dakota University system received a very detailed report, specifically laying out all of the vulnerabilities that we saw and providing remediation guidance for all of those vulnerabilities. So if you turn to the methodology component of the report, I'll go through real quickly at a high level how we do this, what we do on our side. Open source collection is what we consider prep work. We'll go out and we'll take a look at what public IP space they have, whether or not they have email addresses, phone numbers, points of contact that we can reference. Depending on what level of engagement we're going to do, we'll utilize that data. For this type of an assessment, the only thing that we cared about was what IP space was public for them. After we have the open source collection, we'll move into network discovery, in which we'll scan that IP space and look for machines that are active. That's known as host discovery. So if a host is found to be active, we'll then start looking at the ports associated with it. Associated with port discovery, we're going to look for well-known ports. HTTP, HTTPS, those are on port 80 and port 443. Things like FTP and Telnet and SMTP, which is your email that goes back and forth. All of those type of applications have ports associated with them. Once we know the port and we know the machine is up and active, we can query it with simple things like, hey, you do email? Yep, I do. What kind of email do you do? I'm this type of an email server. Or if it's web, I'm running Apache, or I'm running Mozilla, or I'm running, you know, whatever your favorite flavor of whatever that is. By doing that, we can find out what version they're running of their tools. So what applications are installed, what versions are installed, and then based on that, a vulnerability database can be compared with that version, and then we can determine what vulnerabilities they may have within their network. If we were performing penetration testing, from there we would go and actually try to compromise those specific machines to determine if we could gain access to them. For this assessment, we did not perform any penetration testing on any of the systems. So we stopped at the point where we could determine whether or not they had vulnerabilities or not. We have had discussions with the state auditor about performing penetration testing, and it's something that we're looking at in the future audit. We list in there the set of tools that we utilize. All the assessments were completed between October the 1st and October the 31st. So all of those systems were scanned in the course of about 1 month. The external assessments were completed as though we were anyone on the internet. So just like if I had shown up at a Starbucks, put my computer, you know, into Wi-Fi mode and got an IP address, that's what it would have looked like in terms of me, you know, going to the North Dakota public site or going to any of the websites that we scanned. On the internal assessments, we would gain access inside of the network like we were a student or like we were part of the faculty and staff within the network. In some instances, to get access to some of the IP addresses that we wanted to scan, we had to get special access on some of the separate VLANs within the school's network. They provided us that access where it was needed, but in general, we tried not to utilize that type of access to get around. Vulnerabilities that were reported were based on CVSS, or Common Vulnerability Scoring System, which is defined by FIRST and is an open standard. We use that so that as we come back for follow-on assessments, they're consistent. We should be able to, if we do this in a year or 2 years from now, we should be able to directly correlate the results from this scan to the next scan, determine whether or not they've done better, whether or not the host still has open vulnerabilities on it, and whether they were detected during the initial scan. So we should be able to use that to get some trending data as time goes on associated with the findings. Okay, that's the beginning part of the report. Are there any questions kind of on the methodology or scope before we move into each of the findings?
I guess not, so go ahead.
Okay, seeing none. All right, so I'll walk through each of the findings. The first four findings were universal both externally and internally within the campus networks, meaning that we found these type of things both on the outside and the inside. Finding number one, unsupported operating systems. 10 of the 12 campuses were found to have unsupported operating systems that were being utilized. These could have been Unix, Windows, macOS, Linux. There were various different operating systems that were uncovered. The issue with this finding is that as vendors stop supporting the operating system as they reach end of life, they no longer provide patches for that operating system. So if a security event happens, or if a vulnerability is exploited in the wild for that system, the operator, in this case, like let's say for a Windows, they may not provide a patch. And Windows specifically stopped supporting Windows 2000 in July 13th of 2010, and they stopped supporting Windows XP Service Pack 2, which is the latest version of XP. They retired that on April the 8th of 2014, which was just recently.
Representative Kennedy.
Mr. Chairman, and you know, on these supports, is there any generic support, you know, support outside of the outside of Microsoft providing for these programs or these applications?
I would say the best answer to that ad is no. Each of the applications is built by a vendor, and that vendor will either support it, or if they're acquired by someone else, you know, they may pick up support and continue supporting it. But in general, it's not like you can go to some third-party contractor and get them to provide patches for Microsoft, right, for their OS. It would be very, very difficult to do that. So I know, let's say in the instance of Windows XP, there are mechanisms to buy extended support, you know, even beyond the, you know, retired lifetime, you can pay, you know, a much, much higher sum of money to potentially get some patch support, but it'll be very difficult to do that, and that cost will go up over time the farther out that you get. So, you know, if standard support might be for software 20 to 25% of the cost of the software, it might go ridiculously up from there. I note in there a Saguna report. You can take the time and go and read that. It basically talks a lot about both operating systems and applications. Saguna has several different reports, actually. They try to put one out every year. So if you walk through there, one of the key components or things that you'll see in that report, about 14 of the vendors that are out there represent about 50% of the software exploits that you see. And they're the big guys. They're the Microsofts, the HPs, the Apaches. They're the ones that they're going to have some code errors, but they're also the ones most commonly utilized. So because of that, they're very often look to from like the hacker community. That's who they're going to go after, because they know every Windows system that's out there is running Windows. They know that, you know, HP products have some kind of HP software embedded in them. So they're looking for the largest opportunities of target that they can go to. And so it makes sense that they're the ones that are targeted the most. Recommendations associated with the OS support is, you know, move from unsupported to supported versions, upgrade to Windows 7 or upgrade to the next version of Unix. If upgrade's not possible, and in some cases it's not, you might have, you know, specialized equipment being part of a system where the box inside that system is a Windows XP box, and for whatever reason to upgrade that XP box and keep it a part of that system with the specialized software might be very, very expensive. In that case, they need to look at some kind of a defense in depth strategy. Figure out how to segregate the system, figure out how to put additional controls on it, figure out how to move it farther inside the network if you need to, but come up with mechanisms to lock it down farther. And those type of things can be done. It's just a matter of them identifying, you know, how they would do that. So one of the things that we talked about with the university system was putting a set of policies in place around that. If they have systems that are in that realm, what policies would they follow? How would they get a waiver process? How would they go through that process? And then that also allows them a mechanism to identify that those systems exist and where they're located at. Because the last thing you want to have happen is if tomorrow an exploit was announced for, let's say, Windows XP, we would surely want to know where is every Windows XP box within that network. And by being able to know where they're at, then you can determine what do I need to do with that box? Is it already patched? Is it, you know, internal to the network enough where it'd be very difficult for an attacker to get to it anyway? But if, on the other hand, it was an externally facing system, I would definitely want to know that as well and determine then what actions do I need to take, you know, for that machine itself. All right, finding number two.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Scarborough.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, sir, I've always heard that the Apple operating system was the least vulnerable, and you're going to have to explain the first sentence on the top of page 8 to me, because you're saying it's the most vulnerable now.
It was one that was noted inside of that report. So if you go and take a look at the Saguna report, they're saying for that year, which was 2010.
So it's like version 6 point something?
Could have been an older version, but probably not 6 point something, but it might have been Mac OS 9 or Mac OS 10 at the time.
Thank you.
So, but to your statement of Apple software or Mac software is the least vulnerable, I wouldn't necessarily say that that's true in all cases. So I'll throw that out there as a point as well. Every set of software has its set of flaws, and as Mac OS grows in utilization, the amount of people who are targeting that system will go up. So, thank you. So finding number two, missing software patches or upgrades. It's imperative that software patches and updates are applied in a timely manner. This dramatically reduces the window in which an attacker has to attempt to gain access to that system or application flaw. At the same time, it's important for security and IT teams within the campus to have time to pull down these patches, put them into the bundles that they generate to roll them out, and test them. So the last thing you want to do is say, hey, I got a security patch. I really, 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 really got to get it out there. It's part of a Microsoft bundle or part of an Adobe bundle or whatever. They roll it out and it breaks two other things that are critical to the, you know, them operating. You know, if they rolled that out and it brought down bulletin board or blackboard or some system that was critical to their operation, that's no good as well. So the IT teams have to play this, you know, dance. They got to have enough time to get the testing done that they need to do, and at the same time ensure that they're getting the security components out there as quickly as possible to make sure that they can you know, effectively push off the hackers and people who are trying to attack the network. So in terms of recommendations, we want to ensure that the campuses are performing vulnerability assessments on a regular basis. When we visited the campus, every campus was utilizing Nessus, which is the scanner that we use for vulnerability assessment, to do their own sets of internal assessments as well. So they are scanning their networks, and the North Dakota University system has made Nessus available to the campuses that don't have a license themselves. The second part of this is applying patches in a timely manner. So we want to make sure that they have policies and procedures that when they've run an ESSA scan and they've identified a set of vulnerabilities, and then they've identified the patches that are applicable to that, what is the time frame to get those applied? If they're critical in nature, is it a week? Is it 2 weeks? So there should be policies that they have in place for that rollout. And if they're going to do something other than what the standard policy is, if it's 2 weeks and they want to wait a month to roll the patch out, they need to get the appropriate waivers or follow whatever the policy is associated with that. The last part of this is potentially evaluating commercial applications that will help manage that process. So there are systems that are available that as patches become available based on vulnerability assessments, they can pull those patches down, start the staging process, and then as they're approved to be rolled out, the application software will actually help them roll them out into the field. And that helps just speed up that overall end-to-end process. So they could use commercially available products to do that. And some of those are represented inside of the report. Any questions on finding two?
Proceed.
Finding number three, easily guessed or default credentials. Every campus in the assessment was found to have systems with easily guessed or default credentials. These are gold mines for hackers. That's pretty much enough said. Basically, being able to get an admin account with full access on a system will let you do almost anything that you want on that system. You can create accounts. You can remove accounts. You can delete stuff. You can set up networking. There's a host of things that can happen. So any of these systems that are found in the network must immediately be resolved or remedied. Recommendations there. Ensure that a password policy that specifies management-related requirements is in place. If you look at the back of the document that you have, North Dakota University system responses are actually in there for each of the findings in the appendix. For this one, they actually have a password policy in place. It already recommends that passwords are utilized. It already recommends that for password rules that they ensure that there's special characters, numbers, and things like that inside the password. So those are good. We would also like to see them enforce requirements for password aging, meaning that if a password's older than, let's say, 3 months, you need to change that password or some time frame. Whatever the policy is, they need to just ensure that that's part of the policy. And then ensure that systems are not deployed with default settings. That's probably the biggest kind of issue that we found. And we'll talk about it again later because this will come up in one of the other findings that we have. Any questions associated with finding three? All right, finding number four, unsupported web server. 15 of the 12 campuses had unsupported web servers. This is similar to the unsupported operating system, but is also serious in a different way. Web servers are typically utilized to convey information out. So they're either being set up for people to log in there and get a piece of data or post things like blogs, different things going on in the university, or they're being used to position data like the university's website might be on one of these web servers. Because often they're internet facing, it's very easy for the attackers to be able to scan these systems. So we want to make sure that they're upgraded because we don't want them to be the entry point into the network. So recommendations, upgrade to supported releases, evaluate the need for the web server. Maybe it's one that was set up 5 years ago, someone doesn't even utilize it any longer, or maybe there's not a need for it. Determine whether or not it can be taken down or removed entirely. And if it is still needed, then move that web server to some release that is supported and meets the requirements associated with the applications that they're running on the back end. Any questions on four? All right. The next set of findings, finding five, are unique to their internal network. Finding five, I labeled as well-known exploits. These are things like, and probably everyone in this room, even if you're not an IT person, you've heard of Heartbleed or Shellshock or IPMI Cyber Suite Zero. They're ones that have been in the news. that, you know, have been on CNN. They've been reported because the exploits are so well known that they took down, you know, lots of systems or were out there, and it was a big thing in the press. So none of these were found external to the network. That's good. But the fact that we found them internal to the network is a little bit disheartening, in the fact that these, because they're in the press, not only did the hackers then kind of know about them, people who had the exploit and were able to try it, but, you know, people who want to be hackers or some of the students maybe who are computer science, they're going to try this. They're going to go online, they're going to do a little research on Heartbleed and Shellshock, and they're going to pull up the code that, you know, could be utilized to try to do these types of exploits. We'd like to not make it easy for them to go through that exercise and see if they can gain access to machines inside the network. So ones that are well known, that are out there, just need to be fixed immediately. All of these, when we talked to the universities when we were on site, were in process of being remediated. They knew about them, but they hadn't been fixed at the time that we were there. So good news, they were only found internally. Bad news, they're well known. The other part of good news is these are all easily fixed. Every one of them is patchable. You apply the patch, that's it, you're done, you move on. The next set of findings are unique to the external networks. Finding number 6 was publicly accessible web applications. Separate from the public websites for the campuses, there were several web applications and appliances that were accessible outside of the campuses. We bring this up separately because many of these systems had default or easily guessed username and password combinations, and some of them were found that were storing or would allow access to PII. So we were able to go into a couple of these systems, pull out data that we shouldn't have been able to access. We verified the applications that we found that had PII. The North Dakota University system has remediated those. So the ones that we were able to get access to, they definitely have resolved. Many of these applications don't need to have external access. They shouldn't be available from the internet. So, you know, our couple of remediation steps were put in place some kind of a policy where you're evaluating whether these systems should even be granted public access or not. If they don't need public access, firewall block them off. We'll make them only visible internally to the campus, and so that the appropriate group of people can see the appliance that actually need to utilize them. If they do need to be publicly placed, properly place them in a DMZ and allow access out to the internet, and then ensure proper authentication is in place. So they should have a username and password, or they should have three-factor authentication, and it should be something different than the default password associated with that appliance. Any questions on that one? All right, finding number 7, lack of firewall or NAT, and NAT stands for Network Address Translation, and I'll explain that in a few seconds. 4 of the 12 campuses use public IP addresses for internal routing within the campuses. Some had bridge firewalls to provide routing rules and some level of application filtering across that device. Network Address Translation allows a network to be protected by a single host, typically a firewall, acting as a gateway into the network and protecting downstream hosts from potential threats on the internet. It also obscures the IP addressing of these hosts so that their address is not easily guessable. And the reason that you want to do this is the public IP space for these universities is published. It's out there. I can go into the DNS records and I can do a query on North Dakota University system and I can get back all the public IP space. So that's all their external IP addresses. If I'm a hacker or someone who wants to attack their network, the same way that we did it as part of this assessment, they can scan that network. So there's nothing stopping them from saying, I want to go to this computer and scan it, and I'm going to go to this one, and I'm going to go to this next one. So by by basically using public addresses on the inside of the network, you've already given them the, kind of the key to how to get to that machine, because you've told them what the address is. So it's just not best practice. It's kind of our recommendations. So recommendations from our side would be, you know, install and configure a routing firewall. You need to provide that so these networks are not publicly facing. And then if the machines that are then being protected by that NAT, if there's something more that needs to be done, then think about, you know, multifaceted security or defense in depth to protect them further if that needs to happen. But definitely they should be removed from the public facing part of the internet.
We have a question, Rip.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, in the last three findings you know, we've talked about are not just about the top three, top five on my list that I find just absolutely shocking, honestly, that this even occurs. And to me, what I see as a problem is at the actual university level, who's ever the heads of the individual campuses, either needs some serious help or maybe they don't have the staff internally, because most of the findings you've been through to me aren't a system problem, a CTS problem, they're an actual university problem. And you're not going to tell us which ones they are, because that would be incredibly foolish, obviously, to do that. But is that a fair statement?
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah, and I think they would agree. I mean, some of them need help in terms of understanding what they need to do. But in general, having a bridged firewall, which is what these guys or these four campuses have, it's not something, it's not recommended best practices, but there are instances where it is utilized. But typically, if it's going to be utilized in this manner, then you're going to apply some of the components of that bridge firewall to make it work the way you want it to work. So you would do application layer filtering. Only certain apps would be able to get in. You might do, you know, filtering in other ways as the traffic comes in and out. So the fact that they have it in place, but they're not doing a lot of filtering on that data coming through, that's the part that's, I think, a little bit, you know, it needs to be ramped up. And we're saying if you're not going to take the time to do that extra filtering, just move to NAT. Because then at least your IP space is protected. Someone can't just guess your IP address and go from there and start trying to gain access.
Well, Mr. Chairman, sir, that's, yeah, the finding number seven. I mean, I'm in the IT business, and I've honestly never heard of anybody not NATing and segmenting the network. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever outside of have, you know, maybe one server here or there. But to me, that one is, whoever the four campuses are, that's where the problem lies in the system, I see, especially with finding seven.
We would agree that it's bad. Any other questions on seven?
Okay, continue.
Okay. So the rest of the findings, finding 8 through 12, all have to do with the web assessment that was completed for the campus websites. So all of the rest of these findings are associated with the campus websites themselves. In some cases, I'll try to explain what these are. In others, they're pretty technically complicated, and I'll just kind of talk through the recommendations. Cross-site scripting was the most common web vulnerability that we found. 9 of the 12 campuses had this. In cross-site scripting, if I send a piece of data into the website, it gives me back that piece of data. So it might be a form, it might be something where I can put in input data. But because it returns it to me unaltered, as an attacker, I can build a social engineering attack, and I can send it to my victim, have them go to that web page, and embed a malicious payload into what they're sending. So I'll send them to an Indus website, it has a malicious payload, they go to the website, the malicious payloads return to their browser, and maybe the malicious payload that I embedded was a keyboard logger. So now as they're typing, I'm getting all of their keystrokes. or I can embed, you know, a Trojan. It depends on what their browser is, kind of what you can do and what might work. But there's various mechanisms. And the reason that they're now susceptible is because the website has an issue, not because the user's browser or anything like that actually had a compromise inside of it. So they're utilizing basically Indus resources to take advantage of people who might be associated with them. And you can social engineer that out. And social engineering, there's several different types. There's phishing, there's farming, there's, you know, dialing them up by phone. So there's a lots of different things, but these specifically would be linked to phishing attempts. The recommendation, just validate the input. They should be able to check if the form is asking for a username or a, you know, a person's name or a password or an address or different things like that. They should be able to validate what data is coming in there. I shouldn't be able to put a malicious payload in there and have it accept it. So it's a simple fix, but they have to go through the web page code in order to make that change. Finding number 9, Clartext submission of password. Passwords, in this case, are submitted over clear text and they're vulnerable to capture by an attacker who's positioned properly inside of the network. We found a few instances where HTTP was being used for login pages or for potentially sensitive information. Those sites should be registering with HTTPS instead. And, you know, all of those that were identified, the university system went back and has remedied.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kimmich.
Mr. Chairman, on how often do they change their passwords on this? What's their policy when you're...
I don't know what their policy is. We didn't do a review of the policy side. That's something we'd have to take up with the university system. I do know they have a policy for passwords, but I didn't read through it to see what it is.
Okay. Continue.
Finding number 10. Oh, sorry. Yeah, so for the Clartext submission of password, the mechanism to fix that is just to move from HTTP pages to HTTP secure. It's a simple change within the web server. Finding number 10, session token in the URL. Basically, when you do a request, you're going to get back a token associated with that. It could be a password. It could be different sensitive information. It might be a credit card identifier, or it could be your credit card number. That gets actually stored in that browser component that comes back, that URI that comes back. Those get logged on the browser, they get logged by the web server, they get logged by a bunch of different devices. So you want to keep the tokens out of there. They should either be in cookies or they should be hidden inside of an HTTP post instead. So recommendation, application should be using some other mechanism other than session tokens. Like I said, they can use cookies, they can hide them in, there's hidden fields inside of HTTP post, and any of those would be acceptable. Finding number 11, SQL injection. When databases are used on the back end of systems, there's mechanisms to query that data. Like you might want to enter a name or a street address or the person's number associated with something and query into the database. The database then is going to give you information about them. Sometimes that SQL call to that database is not constructed properly and the attacker can modify the physical call into the database and either get more data out of the machine than they should have out of that database, or could take over control of the machine itself. So for SQL injection, if it occurs, the recommendation is use parameterized queries. You basically look at the data before it's allowed to be accepted. Again, if it's a name, I would expect it to be characters and maybe numbers. If it's a street address, it needs to follow a certain format. So you want to evaluate that before you put it into the query. And then prepared statements are generally generated after that parameterized query. And the prepared statements fix how the call actually gets sent down into the database. That way, it's not easy to alter, and if they screw something up, it's liable to not work. It won't go through the prepared statement. Any questions on that finding? All right, last one, serialized object and HTTP message. This one's very complex, so I'll just say my recommendation is avoid serialized objects. If anyone wants to know more about serialized objects and how they work, we can talk about it afterwards, but it's very complex to kind of describe how it actually operates. So those are the findings from the report. We listed a set of summary recommendations at the end that are kind of a set of overarching. Number one, training. Cybersecurity awareness training should be provided for the North Dakota University System personnel, faculty, and staff on a yearly basis. This will provide, you know, basically basic social engineering awareness. We have some training that's actually planned with the North Dakota University System that we're providing in about 2 weeks. So that will cover off some of that requirement. Specialized training for the IT staff on best practices in information security and on use of the vulnerability scanning tools should also be provided. That way they understand what best practices are there and potentially how to integrate those tools with other aids to make that process go as quickly as possible. Getting from, I know it's a vulnerability, to getting it patched, to getting it put out into the field. Deploy defense in depth strategies or multifaceted security, especially in areas where standard recommendations may not be adequate. So this is for those areas where they have a Windows XP box that for whatever reason can't be upgraded, and it might cost $1 million or $2 to resolve the problem or get the system fixed. All right, well, we don't, you know, that's not an option, can't go down that path, but they can do defense in depth. So they can pull it farther into the network, they can do MAC filtering. There's a bunch of other tools that they can use to put roadblocks between the internet and that machine. Patching update process and automation of patching were applicable. So if there's mechanisms for them to get from that vulnerability assessment to application of that patch quicker, they should take advantage of those. So look at commercially available systems, determine how to integrate that vulnerability scanner into that patching system so that it's pre-pulling those patches and getting them ready to be pushed out into the network. Social engineering should be done, I would say, minimum yearly, but quarterly is recommended, and track awareness of how that training is going. And social engineering, as we discussed early, means phishing or USB drops or, you know, doing dialing type attempts to their help desk or their IT staff to determine whether or not they're going to do something that you're requesting them to do without the proper credentials. So if I call them and say, hey, I have a problem with my machine, you know, there's something going on, you know, I don't have my username and password, can you give it to me? Here's what I think my username is. They shouldn't be giving you someone else's password. So things like that. Want to do testing and make sure that they're performing as expected. And penetration testing to validate findings from the vulnerability assessment. We want to be able to demonstrate the results to the IT staff, and at the same time, as we're going through that testing, we want the IT staff to be looking for the things that we're doing. So, did you catch me scanning your network? Did you catch me doing the port enumeration? Did you see that I fired an exploit at this specific server? And did you catch that? And if you didn't catch it, what changes do we need to make inside of your network so that you can catch that? Is it an IDS? Is it a tuning of the system parameters? What do we need to do to make sure that you're seeing the things that you should see if someone's looking like they're an attacker within your network? So for all of these things, for the social engineering, for the vulnerability assessment, for the pen testing, all of those should be engagements with those IT staffs to make sure that they're evaluating, you know, what their system is doing on their side and whether they're seeing those components. That's the end of the presentation. Any questions?
Yep. Ripley Stradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What would be your recommendation in the private sector, you know, monthly internal vulnerability scannings, or every couple of weeks, at least that's what I do, and annual pen tests and external vulnerability is the norm. Would you recommend that from the state level on the university system and the ITD as well?
Yeah, typical vulnerability assessments from a commercial level is usually yearly. Externally, I might do more like, you know, twice a year or something like that, if you had the staff and the budget to do it. Internally, you could do a little bit less, because it really depends on how quickly your commercial entity is changing. So if they change a lot, maybe more. If they don't change IT resources a lot, maybe less, but at least yearly.
Mr. Chairman. And then to follow up on that question I asked before about the how I view this as specific campus, not really a university system office issue. What, and I know you maybe didn't get into in depth, but what could we do to help consolidate the operational side of this or the security side of this? And maybe you didn't get into that, because some of this, like I said, most of it is individual campuses. I don't really see a global solution for some of this unless we were to push all the stuff, consolidate all the universities into one, under one banner.
Yeah, I don't know if I myself am the best one to necessarily answer that question. I think it would take some input both from the university system as well as input from the campuses to try to get a proper balance. I know some of the data does already come through the university system. As we were preparing to do our assessment, they were putting additional technology in place to look at, you know, data that's transiting in and out of the network. It wasn't completely up when we did this assessment, and it, you know, it'll be interesting to see when the next assessment is run how much that, you know, impacts the ability of the assessor to actually reach those systems and interact with them. So even within the assessment that we ran, some of the components that we tried to do were blocked by, you know, firewalls that they have in place and different protective mechanisms. But it didn't always block some of the other attempts. Like some of the stuff we saw, we thought it was weird. We tried it a different way and it worked. We were able to get through. So I think, you know, as you know, it's a complicated question to answer, because it's going to take resources on the university system side if you move the campuses underneath of them, and a lot of those assets today belong to the campuses, so it's a, you know, it's a balancing act of how you put that together. And as you're aware, some of the campuses did very well on the assessment, others didn't do nearly as well, so there's kind of an evolution of getting them to that level. But they're also very different. You know, you have some very, very small campuses with small IT staff, and you have some very, very large universities with a lot of networks and a lot of systems to protect.
And then, but in general, consolidation is usually the best way to go.
It could be one approach, yeah, in terms of getting them under a common umbrella. And if nothing else, I would say, from my perspective, a push toward common policies and procedures would be very helpful for all of the campuses involved.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and sir, is the experience level, you know, you brought up large, small, where were you seeing, was experience or?
It varies, because we saw, like, one of the small campuses had a great set of a great report. But I think it's because their local IT staff is just very good. And the large campuses, I mean, they did pretty well, but, you know, they have a larger IT staff, but at the same time, they have a lot more machines to manage within the network. I'd say overall, most of the systems that we evaluated were pretty average to what we would see in commercial enterprise. So it's typical of what we would see out there. Some were worse, some were better. But I'd say they're fairly.
But the weak link is the human link, then.
That's always the case. There's nothing you can do about that. Well, not nothing. You can do some training, but it's even if you train. We talked about it earlier in a meeting that we had. Typically, best case for social engineering, you can get it back down to about 10%. So if 1 in 10 of you is a weak link, I can start dialing around the room or sending emails, and someone's probably going to click through. So, and we see that. We do quarterly assessments, you know, within our company. We have hardly ever done better than 10%. And we have an absolute fantastic training program.
Representative Scarpa.
Thank you. Eric, excuse me.
I'm assuming you've had conversations subsequent to your findings, and that I'm curious whether or not you think the findings that you had are being adequately addressed at this point in time.
Yes, most of the findings that are inside of this report, I won't say all of them, but a lot of them, especially the critical ones, have already been addressed. The ones that were most concerning to us are things like default username passwords. So for those machines, we were able to go back and verify for the university system that the corrections that they had put in place were resolved and worked.
And as far as the outdated operating systems that are, you know, no longer supported, was it your impression with the subsequent discussions that those operating systems were in the process of being replaced with new and current systems?
So some of them were upgraded in cases where the machine could be updated and there weren't either applications or associated peripherals that blocked that component. But there were instances associated with systems that had, like I said, either peripherals or something attached to it where it would just be prohibitive to do the update. In some cases it was monetarily prohibitive, in other cases, you know, maybe there wasn't a driver or whatever in place to support moving to the next release. And our discussion with the university system was, okay, so then what are you going to do? And it needs to be that defense in depth strategy. You know, you either move it farther in, set up another, you know, firewall around that machine, or if the machine's used for a specific purpose, like if it's part of a lab or something like that, determine how you get the individuals that are associated with utilization of that lab, find out what their access machines are, you know, and do, you know, MAC filtering. So what is their MAC address? Is it on the list? Is it allowed to go through? Those type of things. So there's other mechanisms. You just need to walk through that, what that is. And our recommendation to North Dakota, specific to the university system, specific to that, was a policy. What is the policy? How are you going to, you know, go through that? Who's signing off on it? Who knows about it? If you're not doing anything to that box, someone needs to know. It just needs to be raised.
Okay.
Is there a question over here as well?
Okay. No, I guess not. Continue.
I'm all done with the report.
You're done?
So if there are no other questions.
Okay, any other questions then for your... Okay. We thank you for your report.
Okay, thank you very much.
Very good. So we'll move on then, and comments by the university system, who's...
Good morning, or good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Feldner, and I serve as the CIO for the university system. We appreciate you allowing the auditors to do the scan of the system, because it was very valuable information for us. From a system-wide perspective, I think Eric really brought out that we have a lot of varying abilities across the campuses, and to be able to get the system-wide perspective so we know exactly what's going on at each campus so we can assist them in mitigating the problems is very valuable. As for the policy aspect, I absolutely agree, and we've started with rewriting existing policies and adding more to them, because they're the... When I got to the system, the security policies were about 10 years old, and so they weren't applicable. Even if they were enforced, they weren't up to date enough. So we have a new security team structure set up to help assist the campuses. We have training. All of the campus CIOs are coming to training next month, sponsored by the auditor's office. We have our core technology services staff has monthly security training that's required of them, and it would ultimately be very useful, I think, if we could get that out to all campuses. When we get to questions, if you get very deep down into, I didn't go to each campus with the with the auditor's office and with Eric. Darren did, and Brad Miller did, who was our security officer, and he's not here today. But Darren can answer any further technical questions, but I'd be willing to answer any of your questions.
Okay, any question for Lisa from either committee? Yes, Representative Straley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lisa, is there anything this body needs to do this session to make it easier for CTS, being the global, or should be the global umbrella for all this? Or is it strictly a policy procedure, stuff that you're just working through, being you've been here for a year yet, but or is there some policy legislative stuff that needs to be done to help assist?
I think Representative Stradley, members of the committee, I think the IT committee has done some bills that are requested, that we requested help with. I think we're still trying to feel out what would help us overall. Because policies aren't in place for us to enforce them across campuses, it's hard to enforce security policy, because there isn't security policy, is what I'm trying to say. So we have to get that through the board before we can enforce those standards.
Okay. Any other question for Lisa?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I guess that concludes our report on the IT audit, and the IT committee is welcome to stay. We've got a few other items to take care of this afternoon yet.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Kepinich.
Do we have to move to approve this?
We'll get to that, yes. So, if anybody from your committee wants to leave, Representative Weiss, it's fine. Otherwise, you're welcome to hang around. And okay, so we're going to continue on with our agenda. We'll move up to the 4:20 item, and we thank the IT committee for being with us this afternoon. Thank you, Representative Weiss. We'll have the state auditor's office come up and give us an update on the performance audit in regards to tuition waivers, and bring us up to date on what's happening there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Wall. I'm with the Office of the State Auditor. I'm here to provide you a brief update in regards to the performance audit on tuition waivers and stipends. What I can report at this time is that the audit is still ongoing. As we've worked on the various aspects, and if you recall, there were 12 specific bullets this audit needed to work through, we've encountered various inconsistencies with the campuses that has really caused us some additional work and delays in the audit process. It is taking quite a bit longer than we had originally planned and anticipated. And so we wanted to provide that update to the committee at this point in time. With the work that we are currently performing and what our expectation is moving forward here, we'd attempt to have a completed performance audit report to you prior to the end of this legislative session. That being said, I need to put the caveat on it, considering what we've ran into already, and say that if we do run into additional delays or areas that cause us to perform additional work, the plan would be to get you some preliminary information prior to the end of session, and then the final report will come out when the audit was completed. So, Mr. Chairman, at that point in time, I said I'd be brief. I think I was, but I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, any question for Jason? I've kind of strong-armed them a little bit to try to get the information to come forward more in a timely manner.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it doesn't happen very often when we make a request that we say we would like it by this date. That kind of puts, it it's not our typical process in regards to what's being done. We have moved in that direction. That hasn't been helpful in all instances because the deadlines are still being not met without any explanations from the campuses, but we're working through that as best we can.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Halstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you seeing any trends that we're giving away the farm, or there's some campuses that have gone way overboard on that action, or is it still cloudy?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would probably go with the cloudy, but it's getting clearer to us at this point what that would be. I think this committee itself, too, has received a lot of information on tuition waivers in the past. We're going to provide you a bigger picture of what the number we believe probably is when it comes to the request that was made on tuition waivers and discounts.
Representative Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you be at liberty to tell us, is there consistency in tuition waivers throughout the system at this time, or are there individual processes that would reflect that we don't have a system at this time? Could you respond to that, or would you prefer to wait?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, generally speaking, performance audits done on higher education have found there to be no university system in the areas that we've reviewed. I don't expect this audit to find anything other than what our past performance audits in higher ed have found and reported to this committee.
Okay. In your request now from the university system for information, and to kind of speed this out along, could you relay the information that we're intensely waiting to have that audit completed and brought before this committee?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to pass that along as well.
Thank you. Any other questions for Jason? Thank you, Jason, for the update. Appreciate it. Okay, let's head up to the 425 item, committee discussion and staff directives. And of course, we have the audit here that we'll need a motion on to accept. Have a motion from Representative Marigold, second.
I'll second it.
Second from Representative Scarpo. Any other discussion in regards to the IT audit? Okay, if there are no other questions, we'll have the clerk call the roll.
Chairman Crate?
Yes.
Belter? Delzer? Dugasburg?
Yes.
Heddlestead?
Yes.
Kels?
Yes.
Kaepernick?
Yes.
Marigold?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
Locke?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Pollard?
Aye.
Ruby?
Yes.
Schmidt?
Yes.
Scarpo?
Yes.
Trottier?
Yes.
Senators Kilger? Lee?
Aye.
O'Connell? Ronvick? Mr. Chairman, the motion passes.
Okay. Motion carries. Any other? Yes, Representative Scarpo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the last meeting of legislative audit and fiscal review, a few of us had a thought about something that we thought should be done. And after having given it more consideration, those same individuals had a discussion. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make a motion.
Okay.
And that motion is intended to try to rebuild the relationship with higher education. And I would like it to be perceived that way. But my motion is for the auditor's office to do a performance audit of the development foundations at the University of North Dakota, North Dakota State University, and Dickinson State University for fiscal years 2012, 13, and 14,
and is part of the Dickinson State University Office or Foundation Audit, the state auditor, may, to the extent possible, review information available for the, from the recent receivership and audit activities of the Attorney General's Office.
Okay, you've all heard the motion. Second to the motion?
Second.
We have a second. Trottier? Representative Trottier, second motion. Further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I believe, I sincerely believe that if we're going to have full disclosure, we need to know what the blended component units at these institutions are doing as well as what the institutions themselves are doing. And without that information, I don't think we can ever rebuild the trust. And that's the reason for the motion.
Senator Lee?
Mr. Chairman, my only comment is that I wasn't a part of the discussion, so I feel like I'm being asked to vote on something about which I really don't have a really well thought-out position. Because, yes, I've been on the committee and all that, but I plan to resist the motion because I don't think... I want to have a better feeling about what I'm voting on before I would support that motion.
Okay. Any other comments, discussion? Representative Maribos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't know who to direct this question to. In those conversations, has there been data or information that might not be known to the rest of us from these development foundations that are causing or could cause us not to repair that relationship if the information wasn't forthcoming? I kind of agree with Senator Lee. I just would like to know what it is in these performance audits that might help us repair that trust. What do we expect to find, or is it a fishing expedition? I just would like somebody to try to answer that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scarpa?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Maribos, I think we're all aware of some things that have transpired that were less than comfortable. And I believe that the Development Foundation can serve a very useful purpose. And I just think that the trust level between the legislature, a lot of the legislature, and I'm not saying all, I shouldn't say blanket legislature, but between a lot of the legislators and higher education is at an incredibly low level. And if there is a serious desire to fix that on the part of both the legislature and the foundations and the institutions, that there's going to have to be openness. Now, there's nothing that I've been aware of. There was nothing in the discussions amongst the few of us in this committee that talked about doing it in October that was specific in any nature to any specific issue. It's just, let's open the doors, since the Attorney General recently ruled that they're subject to open records. Let's take a look. Let's see what good they're doing. Let's see how much scholarship money they're providing. Let's see what they're providing to the institutions. Why would we not want to know that and then be able to congratulate them for that without the suspicion associated with the things that have transpired in the past?
Representative Myers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scarpa, thank you for those comments. I guess my further question would be, can we receive that information under the open records law without a performance audit? I assume that the performance audit will be somewhat costly. And if we could get these development foundations to come down and give us that information, as if we, you know, if we specifically ask, if we're, you know, obviously now that these are open records, I can't imagine that they wouldn't
voluntarily want to give us that information, if somebody would like to comment on that.
Representative Maribos, we're looking, you know, we're not doing the whole system, it's just the three, you know, three schools, yes. Representative, Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, that's really the direction I was headed, was really in the area where Representative Maribos just went. I know, we all know that there have been challenges with Dickinson, certainly. I think that there are a lot of efforts being made to work that out, and I think that it will be perhaps important to have the open records information available. I think it's a difficult time right now for NDSU to do it, not that they won't if we tell them they have to, but they're just in the middle of searching for a new director of their development foundation, and they have some other new staff. And it is always tougher when it's new staff than it is when it's somebody experienced and they're looking for things. I'm not showing for these groups. I just think that the open records determination is fairly recent. We have a couple of situations that are unique and sometimes unacceptable. We know there are big challenges, particularly with what's going on in Dickinson, but I think that Dr. Costin is trying to make sure that the folks on that development side, I recognize the division, and people in the community are making every effort to make that work. I guess if I got to pick, I would rather have the open records request getting information for us and perhaps look a year down the road when they've got their staff all in place and some reorganizations completed there, and we'll have their feet a little bit better on the ground under the new systems. Look whether or not we think it's still important that we might consider do a performance audit at that time.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I've got a question to the chairman or to Representative Scarpa. I'm confused now. Is was the motion for a performance audit on the development foundations for just those two institutions? So what? There was three. I missed one of them. So it's University of North Dakota. I didn't hear that. Okay. So it's University of North Dakota, North Dakota State University, and Dickinson State University. And the intent is to a performance audit of the development foundations only, correct? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scarpa.
If I might, you know, I understand, you know, the open records request. Trust me, I've been there. And while I can appreciate that perspective, I think in the case of trying to rebuild a relationship that has been as damaged as this one, you needed a third party to present the information, to take a look at the information, present the information, you know, to rebuild that relationship. It's a bit like a friendship that's lost, trying to be rebuilt. It's much easier to build that friendship and retain it than it is to rebuild it after you've come to the verge of destroying it. And I mean, that's kind of where it's at. And I mean, as far as a lot of us, now I realize not all of us, but my efforts here are short term, because I'm not planning on being back here for the next legislative session to be punitive toward anyone. But I think that if this legislature and the next legislature are going to rebuild a relationship with higher education, and I have hopes that it will get rebuilt for the first time in a lot of years, you know, I think we have to do this in order to clear the air and have an open and honest conversation between the parties.
Any other comments? Senator Lee.
Mr. Chairman, would you be willing to ask someone from the auditor's office to just discuss timing, because they appeared before a committee a day or two ago on which I sit, and there were some timing issues. So perhaps Mr. Wall would be willing to let us know what they can do for us at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Right now, as you know, we're doing the performance audit on tuition waivers and stipends. This committee also has a motion passed for a performance audit on the Department of Trust lands that, with the lag in or the downtime with requests from campuses coming in, we did start our background work in relation to that audit. So with those two audits right now, we would probably be looking, you know, towards the end of June, July range, in regards to, and possibly even later in regards to, where those two audits wouldn't be done. I had informed Senator Lee's committee that there are current bills this session for performance audit as well. Hers was the state hospital performance audit. On the House side, there is a bill in for a performance audit on oil and gas division and the Department of Health. Both those bills would require us to get them done the next biennium. I would say if those two bills were to pass, and the requirement that each bill says needs to be done that next biennium, all our current resources that we currently have in the performance audit section would be used up completing the two we're doing right now and those three if they were to pass.
Okay. Representative Maribel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I assume that the motion... requires a full scope. The scope of this performance audit is a full scope performance audit. Or does it need to be directed and narrowed? Is that your understanding of the motion, that it would be a full scope performance audit of everything that these development foundations do?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my understanding of the motion is a performance audit on the foundations at three campuses. The scope of the audit will be set similar to the performance audits we do on projects. We would do some background information, the foundations here, and we would try to narrow that scope down to perform specific field work and tests. What that would be, hard to say till we see what's going on in the foundations.
If I may continue, would that require you to come back to the committee or just make those decisions independently of the committee?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, once we set that scope, we would report that to the committee now. You would receive an email from me telling you what the scope of the project would be if there are questions, or we would certainly come back to this committee as well.
Representative Scarpa.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jason, in the audits that you referred to as pending and with regard to the current motion, is it not possible that you could utilize contractors to do some of this work?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we certainly could. We did report to Senator Lee's committee that to do the performance audit on the state hospital, we expected to need to hire a consultant specifically. There is always that opportunity. I'd like for the committee's information too, if we were to hire a consultant for any performance audit, we need to come to this committee first, receive your approval prior to us ever going forward and putting an RFP out for somebody to hire and select. The audited entity pays that bill, not the auditor's office.
Any other questions? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, as I understand Representative Scarpel's motion, I think I keep hearing the word development foundation, and I just want to make sure that we don't miss out on something and that there isn't confusion from our office's standpoint in what this committee will be looking for if the motion were to pass, because I certainly don't want lawyers to make the determination that he said development foundation, we're no longer a development foundation, we're the alumni and the Alumni Association Foundation. So these campuses, especially the big two, do have multiple foundations. I know that sometimes the names change. For example, I don't believe UND any longer uses Development Foundation from what I learned this morning. And what I'm looking at from our office's information that I have on foundations, but you know, NDSU is going to have a Development Foundation. They also have a Research and Technology Park Foundation. They have a Research Foundation. They have the Tea Makers Club Incorporated Foundation. And those are their bigger ones, all of which have assets of well over $4 million. So I want to make sure if we're looking for Development Foundation or just the largest foundation of the campus, just to make sure that we're clear so we don't give you something you didn't intend to receive.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, you know, it's difficult to get into semantics when I'm not as familiar as I probably should be with the duties, but I mean, the intent would be the largest blended component unit that is intended for both academic ancillary contributions supportive of the university. Now, I don't want the, some of those you named, but I mean, I don't know how else to state it.
No, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's clear to me.
You want to conclude that in your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And the second, fine with that?
Yes.
Okay. So then we have the motion on the floor and the second. If there are no further questions, we'll call for the vote.
Chairman Crate?
Yes.
Belter? Belzer? Ugesberg?
No.
Hellestead?
Yes.
Couch?
No.
Kaepernick?
Yes.
Nagels?
Yes.
Levinson?
Yes.
Mock?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Pilot?
Yes.
Ruby?
Yes.
Schmidt?
Yes.
Skypo?
Yes.
Trotter?
Yes.
Senators Kilgore? Lee?
No.
O'Connell? Wanzek? Chairman, the motion passed.
The motion passed, and we'll work with the auditor's office, and they'll, you know, in a timely manner, get going on that. So, anything else for the good of the committee? If not, our next meeting will be when we have the audits to take a look at. Probably be towards the end of the session or even after the session. So, motion to adjourn. Okay, we are adjourned. I thank all of you for coming today and your participation. Thank you.
So nobody's asking who's going to make it.
It depends upon what castles are in the house. And whether the land department or trust lands one day. No, we don't.
Mr. Chairman, are we adjourned?
We are.
No, everybody just.
Well, my point of the whole deal is, if you've done nothing wrong, what do you got to worry about?
Well,
Nick, it would have been good if Dickinson would have asked.
I would have asked.
And that's their problem, is it not? I mean, what we're finding out about the tuition rate.